Hi again, everybody. It's Alan, and it's the Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Joining us today to discuss obstetrics and gynecology are Drs. Amy Novat and Rachel Mash. They're brought to you courtesy of my very good friends, the Brodies. A member of the Mid-Hudson Medical Group practicing in Rhinebeck and Kingston, Dr. Amy Novat is a graduate of New York Medical College in Manhattan, formerly the chief resident at Reading Hospital in Reading Hospital and Medical Center in Reading, Pennsylvania. Novat received certification from the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology in 2009. Also joining us today is Dr. Rachel Mash, Associate Director of the Division of Family Planning at Beth Israel Medical Center in Manhattan, a graduate of Brown University School of Medicine in Providence, Rhode Island, and having earned her Master's of Public Health degree from Columbia University in 1999. Mash is also certified by the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Her main areas of interest are family planning, contraception, education, and cervical cancer screening and prevention. Dr. Novak, Dr. Mash, welcome to the Vox Pop. The number to call, everybody, and believe me, these phones are going to be ringing off the hook in a minute. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wmc.org/voxpop. You can also just write us at voxpop@wamc.org. Okay, so here we go. The phones are beginning to ring already, so let me ask you very quickly, guys. What is it that men should know about gynecology?
What is it they should know?
What are the obvious things that guys should know about what you do?
So there's a lot, and that's a difficult question, I think, to answer in a short amount of time. But one thing I think that guys should know is that HPV, the human papilloma virus vaccine, is not just for women. So the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that boys also get vaccinated against HPV. So it's not just girls.
Is that happening?
I think it's starting to happen more, yes. Uh-huh. I think it was initially touted as a vaccine for young girls and young women, and now with hopefully more publicity about it, there is going to be more young boys and men getting vaccinated as well.
As long as we're on the subject, at one point somebody told me, a doctor told me, that it's almost, before the vaccinations, it's almost universal that almost everybody had the HPV virus in them. That doesn't mean they have the outbreak of the disease, right?
That is correct. So anybody who is sexually active, almost all of them are exposed to HPV. HPV is the human papillomavirus, and it is what is 100% responsible for cervical cancer. It is also responsible for some laryngeal and penile and anal cancers as well, which is why boys should also be vaccinated against HPV. But it is the sole thing that is responsible for cervical cancer. And having been able to elucidate that over these last several years has been a huge breakthrough in gynecology.
And so let me ask Dr. Amy to give us something that, you know, she thinks we ought to be thinking about.
Well, forever, men should be knowledgeable about women's cycles and how that relates to contraception and fertility. And I'm amazed at the number of men who might walk into my office with their partners and not have any real understanding of when a woman is most fertile and the role of the varied contraceptive techniques in preventing pregnancy. Certainly they're aware of condoms, but outside that they have really very little understanding of what are the options for women.
So when are women most fertile?
Well, if a woman has a so-called regular cycle, and we usually talk about a 28-day cycle from starting from the first day of a menses to the first day of the next period, we talk about day 14 being the ovulation time frame. And we talk about the most significant time for pregnancy 2 days before and 2 days after that, so day 12 through day 16. But of course, many, many women do not have the perfect cycle. Their days between one period and another may be 29 days, 32 days, 21 days.
So you could guess wrong very easily.
You can. And of course, it's only easy to know retrospectively when you might have ovulated, because it's only after you get your period you say, ah, it's been 23 days since my last one, or 29 days since my last one. So it's really very important to use a contraceptive technique that really protects you as well as possible in the face of the changes that can occur.
Amy, what's hot in contraception right now? You know, there was a period where everybody was on the pill, and that became, there were problems with that. What's the preferred method of contraception now?
Well, the most popular form of contraception in this country is still the birth control pill. But what's really interesting and have they improved? They've been great for a long time.
Okay.
You know, it's one of these medications that we've had around for 60 years. And so we have a lot of data about safety, efficacy, and certainly they change every once in a while. Actually, Dr. Mash and I were talking about a new pill on our way up here, and the companies will change them according to dosages and new approaches to have pills that are chewable as opposed to those that you swallow. Mm. But they're certainly a very common and popular modality because they're so easy to take. But what's particularly interesting right now are these long-acting contraceptive techniques, specifically intrauterine devices and different implants that are providing years of contraception without having to attend to a daily intake or a daily kind of intervention.
Any downsides to those, to those things which are inserted into your body?
These inserts can have complications mostly around perhaps some irregular bleeding. There is no perfect contraception other than abstinence.
Yeah.
So, but their pregnancy rates are you know, less than 1%. They're very, very small. So most of the time, these techniques are very well tolerated and work beautifully.
Who does them? Who inserts them?
Gynecologists in offices or practitioners at places like Planned Parenthood or
clinics.
So it's
not a major surgical...
No. And that's the beauty of them, is that to have them introduced is a relatively straightforward approach.
Okay. Look, we'll take some phone calls. And here we go to Marie in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Our doctors are Dr. Amy Novat and Dr. Rachel Mash. Okay. Marie in Greenfield, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I am about 7 years fully postmenopausal and no health complaints. I'm in good health, but I get this intense itching in my perianal and vulva area, and I don't. Everybody that I ask doesn't seem to know what causes it. It's periodic, it's not all the time, and interestingly enough, it only happens at night. So I'm asking you, what's causing this problem?
So have you seen anybody about this yet, Marie?
Yes, I did. I've seen my lady doctor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have hemorrhoids by any chance?
No, I don't.
No, because sometimes that can cause either internal or external hemorrhoids can cause some perianal and perineal itching. There's also, do you have any changes in your bowel habits, diarrhea or constipation?
No, nothing like that. Everything's fine. And it's in the vulva area as well. It's like all that whole region just gets this really intense itching, and it's not really a rash. It's just horribly intense itching. And I've been using hydrocortisone cream to relieve it, and then it goes away, and it's fine. And it's interesting that it only happens at night.
And is it after, do you notice it after you've been working out or after a long day or wearing certain pants that might be tight or anything? Are there any triggers that you can identify?
No, I haven't been able to. That's why I thought I'd call and ask you folks. Is there a bodily reason why this is happening? Is it some sort of hormonal thing? I just don't understand why I keep getting this horribly intense itching in that area.
Dr. Novak.
Hi, Marie. This is actually a very common lament. And in fact, most women with vulvar or perianal itching will complain that the nighttime is the worst. And probably it's a combination of reasons. One, because you're busy all day long and then you're lying down at night and you don't have as much on your mind and you're not as distracted. But also, when we're lying in bed at night, there's a certain amount of perspiration that goes on and moisture that collects in that area, which I have no doubt exacerbates these rashes. So the first step would be, if you have seen people, I would recommend a biopsy of the area just to make sure that there is nothing more serious going on than perhaps a simple, if you will, rash. The second thing is be wary of the hydrocortisones because ironically or paradoxically, these medications can thin the skin and make them more at risk for rashes. Often what I find in my office is that, funny enough, these rashes are kind of a combination of issues. One, certainly being in the postmenopause where the hormonal environment has changed sufficiently that the bacterial flora is also changing and responding to that change in pH and hormones, but also sometimes what we're doing in our daily life. As Dr. Mash asked about these triggers, sometimes just the foods we eat, it can be funny enough, we can sometimes manifest a food allergy in that area. Certainly many, many women are using soaps that are antibacterial, and in fact, you want to keep the bacteria on your skin down there. It's our armor, it's our protection. Women also love really hot showers and really hot baths. This denudes the skin and makes you more at risk. So often what has to happen is you just have to kind of recolonize the area.
Okay, what about fungus?
Fungus is a very real phenomenon, and it's present in it's actually part of our normal flora, and it certainly can be a cause for rashes in the perineal area. So that's certainly, getting a culture of the area is certainly very important.
Okay, we got to go to take a break.
Okay,
so Bob,
thank you.
So thank you, Marie. So bye-bye. Bob and Samantha, stay on. We'll be back in seconds. Well, I think Samantha may. Oh no, she's there. Okay, so Bob and Samantha, stay right where you are. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Furniture Options Goshen, specializing in the stressless functional reclining chair engineered for head, lumbar, and body weight support. FernOps.com. St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery. Choose STMary's.com. The Garrison in the Hudson Highlands, a country inn and the Valley Restaurant, now open all year with Hudson River views, private event spaces, winter getaway packages, and holiday gift certificates available. TheGarrison.com. And Bassett Healthcare Network, bringing heart care to the people of Herkimer, Cobleskill, Cooperstown, Oneonta, and surrounding areas. Bassett.org.
And we're back, thanks to Zach the engineer. Okay, so we've got Bob and Samantha holding on the phone, but first, very quickly, coming into our headquarters here is from Donna. I was recently told that I only need a pap every 3 to 5 years. I'm 51, not menopausal, and still sexually active and monogamous for 30 years. Can you explain these changes, and do they apply universally?
So, Donna, I am so glad you asked this question because this is a point of confusion for many, many women. We spent, as gynecologists, decades convincing women to come in annually for their exams and their pap smears. And now we are changing those recommendations. And there is a good reason for that. It is because we now know what causes cervical cancer. And that is relatively new. So it's the human papillomavirus, the thing I was talking about at the beginning of the show, that causes 100% of cervical cancers. And we are now able to test specifically for the high-risk HPV types that cause the cervical cancer. There are two subtypes of HPV, HPV 16 and 18, that are 70% responsible for all cervical cancers worldwide, which means that there are 30% of cervical cancers that are caused by different subtypes of HPV, which we have also been able to identify. But now we are able to test for these high-risk HPV types, and so when we do pap smears, we not only do a pap smear, but we also test for HPV. And in being able to look at the pathophysiology of this disease, from the time somebody has a negative pap smear and a negative HPV test if they have never had a high-grade or abnormal pap smear in the past, if they're over 30 years old and their pap smears, again, have been normal in the past and they have a negative pap and a negative HPV test, the chance of their getting cervical cancer in the next 5 years is almost zero. And if they were to get exposed to a high-risk type in the subsequent 5 years from their negative testing, the chance of how long it takes to develop invasive cancer is anywhere from 10 to 20 years, but more likely 15 to 20 years.
So can you do anything about it if you have, cervical cancer?
Yeah, so what we try and do is identify these early stages or pre-cancer, and we are able to treat pre-cancers long before they
become...
a problem. So we can either freeze the cervix or we can excise the portion of the cervix that is affected by the HPV, the high-grade HPV, that is changing the cervix into a precancerous with precancerous cells. So we either excise or we freeze.
Okay. Well, Marie, Bob, who was that? Was that Bob? No, I don't know who that was.
That was Donna.
That was somebody.
Oh, Donna. Yeah. Oh, you are so good to me. Thank you for bringing me back to my mind. Okay, let's go to Bob in Akron. Bob, you're on.
Okay, thank you very much. My wife has been a long-time patient of Dr. Novat, and I just was curious what the status of testing for... metabolites of estrogen, some of which might be more toxic and more indicative of risk for breast cancer, and others that would potentially be more protective. And I'd heard about that some years ago and wondered if there's anything more known about that now.
Thank you. Bob, it's a great question, and it's an interesting topic of which there isn't a lot of information. You know, there are three types of estrogens in a woman's body: estrone, estradiol, and estriol. And estradiol is the one that's most active during women's reproductive life. And then once we're in the menopause, the estriol, or E3 as we call it, becomes the more active type of estrogen. And there's a group of thinkers out there who talk about the relative safety and perhaps even the protective effect of estriol, E3, whereas estradiol is felt to be the causative hormone or participatory hormone in cancers of the breast and the uterus. We haven't really identified a way of measuring these estrogens in a way that helps us understand their protective or risk potentials. Because it's a difficult science measuring hormones. It's not just how much is in the blood or how much is in the saliva or how much is in the urine. It's also about what the receptor level is and how those hormones might be in the individual's body. So your wife might be measuring, 5 picograms per deciliter of estradiol, or another woman's measuring the same. But where those estradiols are going in her body is variable, because we have receptors. Women have receptors for estrogen all over the body. And we haven't been able to map that out yet and understand what that means vis-a-vis cancers or other illnesses.
Could I just ask a follow-up question on that? I mean, vis-a-vis the risk, do you feel that there is enough evidence to recommend a protective effect of crucifers?
I think that there's some data that shows that they can certainly be protective. There's a lot of discussion about DIM and these other compounds that seem to be protective, but there's not a lot of science about it. I think that cruciferous vegetables are great for you, and certainly if you can eat them organically, there's no question that they're protective and assisting your well-being overall.
So, my ignorant question is, what's a cruciferous vegetable again?
Broccoli, cauliflower, cabbages.
Bushy things.
Yeah.
Rachel, do you want to add anything to this?
No, I think I would agree with Amy that we don't yet have enough information. And we know from the way estrogen reacts in from the birth control pills, for example, or in the combined hormonal contraceptives, that women deal with different the same hormones in a very different way. The estrogen and progestins that are in the combined hormonal contraceptives, one woman may love it and the other woman really has bad side effects. And so it speaks to the same point that Amy was making, that about we need to see how these compounds interact in an individual. So we don't have, and there's no great literature yet to help us with absolute values.
So, Bob, you have your answer. We got to move on.
Thank you very
much.
Thanks a lot. Take
care.
Goodbye.
Okay. Let's go to Samantha in Albany. Samantha, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I went to my yearly exam, and I spoke to my nurse practitioner about possibly trying the IUD. She thought it would be a great idea for me. So I went. She doesn't put them in herself, so I went to a different doctor within the practice to have it done. When he was doing it, I guess it popped out and put it back in. And about 4 days later, I just didn't feel right. I felt really sick. I was really achy from my hips down, and I had a fever. So I went to the doctor that put it in my IUD in, and he'd asked, if I had kids, and I had said no. So he said, if there's an infection, we need to take it out now. So they took it out, and he kind of said, I must have had chlamydia or gonorrhea, but I was tested, and I didn't. So I'm just trying to find out if it was, I had an ultrasound done, and I had blood work done, and they said that my white cell count was really high, which was indicative of an infection. So I was just calling to find out if it's, an IUD is still something I should try in the future, or if it was my body rejecting it, or if it was an infection caused by maybe the marina popping out and then putting back in.
So Samantha, I'm sorry you had to deal with all of that. That sounds not so much fun, but it sounds like, yes, indeed, you did have an infection, and it's unclear based on your story whether or not there was an infection that was seeded based, you had something already existing and then that was seeded with the placement of the IUD, or if you developed an infection after. But I don't think that you should, after that experience, I understand you might be a little bit gun shy about getting another IUD, but I do want to tell you that IUDs do not cause infections per se, and that it is a really great form of birth control, the long-acting reversible contraceptives. And I think that you are certainly still a candidate for an IUD, and the three different IUDs, I'm not sure which one you had, but the three different IUDs available, two of which have progestin. One of the progestins is good for 3 years. One is good for 5 years. The copper IUD is good for 10 years. And there has been no evidence to suggest that they cause infections.
So what could have happened here?
Well, I think that there may have been an existing something in the vaginal flora or in the cervix that might have been seeded, or if the IUD had been displaced, there could have been some seeding of some bacteria that might have caused an infection after the placement of it, particularly because Samantha, you weren't feeling well and your white blood cell count was elevated, which is usually indicative of an infection. Mm-hmm. Many times when there is an infection with an IUD in place, we don't always need to remove it. We used to do that all the time, and now we know that we can treat with antibiotics unless the IUD has been displaced. And if the IUD is not in the correct position, if it's in the endocervical canal or crosses the internal os, we recommend the internal opening of the cervix, uh-huh. So the gateway to the uterine cavity. Yeah. Then we recommend if the IUD is not up in the top of the top of the uterus or the fundus of the uterus, but if it's down low crossing into the cervix, then we recommend that it be removed. But with infection just in and of itself, we can usually treat that. And if women are not then getting better, we then can remove that.
And when the doctor inserts these, obviously you've got to be very careful about the potential for introducing infection, right?
Sure. Sure. Anytime we do anything through the cervix and into the uterus, we always have to be careful about infection. The vagina is like the mouth, though. I mean, we have normally growing bacteria, fungus, and there are normal flora in the vagina, just like there is in the mouth, that helps us. That's mm-hmm. not all bad.
Okay. Samantha, are we done?
Can I ask a follow-up question really quick?
Go ahead.
Sorry. So I had a leap procedure done a year and a half before, which he said the reason it popped out was because there was scarring. Could there have been some sort of bacteria there, or is an infection in that sense, or just regular bacteria in my body kind of thing.
I don't think the leap had anything to do with the infection. It certainly can create scarring or what we call stenosis or narrowing of the canal.
What's leap?
Leap is a procedure that is done when someone has an abnormal pap smear. It's an excision technique to remove abnormal cells. So I don't think the leap caused the infection.
Okay.
Samantha, thank you.
All right, thank you.
You're right. And let's go to Veronica in Schenectady. Veronica, you're on.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call, doctors. I have a question basically on endometrial cancer or uterine cancer in a woman who's postmenopausal, 10 years postmenopausal, and had a recent pap smear, which came back, you know, negative for your typical pap, and it tied into what you already said about now they're thinking 3 to 5 years between paps is okay, postmenopausal women with no other issues or symptoms, but she ended up having a light pink discharge on a white tissue, which then she went back to her gynecologist, and they said, let's check you for uterine cancer, at which point they did an ultrasound, and it did come out positive. Is there any way to identify for uterine or endometrial cancers? Apparently, a pap smear is not the definitive diagnosis for even identifying that.
Okay, I just want to remind everybody, we're listening to Dr. Amy Novant and Dr. Rachel Mash. Rachel, you're next.
So you are absolutely correct, Veronica, that a pap smear is not the way to diagnose uterine cancer. Pap smears diagnose cervical cancer, which is quite different. The cervix is at the base of the uterus and is what you see when you put a speculum inside during your annual exam. It's what dilates when women are pregnant. But the uterus is a different organ, and it responds, it's a different, how we test for cancer of the uterus is different. So the pap smear, an HPV, tests for cervical cancer, and the test for uterine cancer is really clinical symptoms. So that when this woman had that spot of bleeding, any postmenopausal bleeding needs to be worked up for uterine cancer. That is, the good news about uterine cancer is that it gives us a sign early on, so that women who are menopausal who bleed, we need to know why they're bleeding. And that can lead to an endometrial biopsy where we sample some of the cells inside the uterus, and or an ultrasound which can show a thickened endometrial lining, which can also be indicative of uterine cancer.
Now, Rachel, which of the cancers is considered to be more dangerous, the uterine, as you say, or the cervical?
Well, these days, both of them have ways of being detected early. So with any cancer, if we have early detection, we can take care of it before it gets to be a really big problem. And so the pap smear helps us to detect cervical cancer in a precancerous stage many times in this country. In resource-poor countries, not so much, because they just don't have access to screening. But in this country, pap smears help us with cervical cancer and clinical symptoms of women, because women tend to bleed early as the lining of their uterus gets more thick. They tend to shed that, and that is an early sign of uterine cancer.
Dr. Amy, did you want to add anything?
No, just to reiterate that, thankfully, in this country, most women who are diagnosed with uterine cancer are diagnosed in stage 1 or perhaps early stage 2. It's a rare event unless someone has been bleeding in the postmenopause for months or years without having seeking medical advice. Mm-hmm. So it is a cancer that's often very early diagnosis and very easily treated.
Okay. Veronica, thank you very much.
Can I ask one other thing?
All right.
So would explain why for her they did automatically schedule a laparoscopic surgery to remove the uterus. I guess that's the standard protocol. And then 3 weeks out, you know, they said the schedule of the surgery. So something finding it so early sounds logical that you wouldn't need emergency surgery, that a scheduled 3-week surgery sounds typical.
Absolutely. It's very, very hard to receive the diagnosis of cancer and then wait. But the reality is for many cancers, not all, but for many cancers, there really is time between that diagnosis and treatment. Now, I'm not talking about months and years, of course not, but certainly for many, many patients, just because of the nature of the busy lives of patients and clinicians, there are several weeks between diagnosis and definitive surgery. And almost always, there's no risk associated with that delay or that time hiatus.
Okay, Veronica, we got to move on. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right. Let's go to Beth in Williamstown. Beth, we're going to, I tell you what, Beth, you stay right there. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll be right back with you. Thanks a lot.
Support comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche, QFCC.com. Middletown Medical, now offering evening walk-in urgent care for children every weeknight until 9, plus evening sports physicals, 845-342-4774. Marriott Townplace Suites, Albany Downtown, offering studio, one- and two-bedroom suites with fully equipped kitchens. Amenities include indoor pool, breakfast, local transportation, Wi-Fi, and parking. TPSAlbany.com for reservations. And Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine-in, takeout, delivery. 518-432-0358.
And we are back, and holding on with us is Beth from Williamstown. Right, Beth?
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
And thanks for your patience. Appreciate it. Go ahead.
Certainly. I'm actually calling on behalf of younger women who are on various birth control methods and maybe later in their lives are interested in becoming pregnant and wanted to know if there are any risks involved in long-term birth control use, in particular the birth control pill and also the birth control device that is inserted vaginally for long-term use. Are there any known risks for long-term use of these regarding future fertility problems?
Dr. Rachel?
Hi, Beth. That's a great question and one that we get asked very often. So long-term use of combined hormonal contraceptives, whether it be the birth control pill or the transdermal patch, or I think what you were referring to was the Nuva ring, the ring that goes in the vagina, all of them have both estrogen and progestin in them. And what many people don't realize is that from studies that we have done now, as Dr. Novet said, the pill has been around for about 60 years, is that we know that the pill for sure, and we have pretty good evidence to suggest the other combined methods actually decrease a woman's risk of ovarian cancer and decrease a woman's risk of endometrial cancer.
Why?
Because the way that they work, the pills, the combined hormonal contraceptives stop ovulation. And we think that when a woman ovulates, the repair of where that egg bursts out of the ovary, if you look at some electron micrographs, it looks like a nuclear bomb explosion as the egg bursts out of the ovary. And when the ovary repairs itself, it's in that repair that we have mutations that can cause ovarian cancer. That is one way of, that's one of the majority of ways of getting ovarian cancer. So by preventing ovulation, we actually prevent that repair process from needing to happen. And with endometrial cancer or uterine cancer is a buildup of the lining of the endometrium. And we know that combined contraceptives keep that lining very thin, which is why we give it to women who have very heavy periods, because it doesn't build up. It prevents the lining of the uterus from being built up. So in those two cancers, you're actually getting a protective effect. Many women have questions about breast cancer, and the data is somewhat mixed about that. There may be a slight increased risk, but after 10 years of being off, the risk then reverts back to what it was before. In terms of that, so that's a cancer risks in a nutshell. There's lots more we could talk about that. But in terms of pregnancy, once you are off a combined hormonal method of contraception and you go back to having regular periods, regular menses, your chance of getting pregnant is whatever it would have been before.
But does it take a long time to get back into the cycle?
For many women, no. Of course, it's a bell curve, right? So for some women, it happens. For most women, it happens almost immediately. Mm-hmm. And for some women, it does take a longer time. Now, you have to remember, many women who have irregular cycles get put on the pill to try and regulate their cycles. Mm-hmm. So once they get off the pill, they go back to what their cycles were prior to being on the pill, which were irregular.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have to take each individual person when we are giving advice.
Beth, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Jean in Schenectady. Jean, you're on. Well, Jean was on, but she's not anymore. Jean, you're not there. Okay. Jean's gone. Okay, let's go to Carolyn in Red Hook. Carolyn,
yes.
You're on.
Hi. I have a question about postmenopausal flashes, hot flashes. I've gone through the hot flash stage, and now I get what I consider warm flashes. And I'm wondering how many years I can expect this and if there's anything I can do to reduce the degree of it.
Hi, Carolyn. You live in my backyard or my northern yard.
It's a nice backyard.
It is. I love the lexicon that goes on with these warm flushes, power surges, hot flushes. It's great. What I usually tell women is that the first 3 to 5 years after the last menstrual period, what's formally called the menopause, is perhaps the most difficult time for many women with regards to these symptoms. After that, most women will describe a decline in the intensity and frequency of those symptoms. So certainly there are many women in their 6th, 7th, even 8th decade who will talk about how they still have a hot flush occasionally, but it's significantly less. There is a cohort of women, about 15% of all postmenopausal women, who will be very symptomatic kind of through the rest of their lives. And they will often resort to using some kind of intervention. And the interventions are varied. Everything from herbal approaches to complementary modalities like acupuncture and homeopathy to hormone replacement therapy to a group of different medications that are used, interestingly enough, for a variety of other purposes. Mm-hmm. For example, Effexor is a medicine that's used for depression, but in a very low dose can effectively get rid of night sweats or hot flushes. Neurontin, any of the SSRIs. So there is an array of interventions, and it's a quality of life issue for what we know about hot flushes or whatever you want to call them. They're not life-threatening, but they can certainly make the quality of one's life quite difficult. So it's always a matter of measuring the risks and the benefits and how you're feeling
now,
overall.
Now, there was a lot of talk for a while about the estrogen replacement. Are we still doing that, or is that basically gone now?
No, there's still conversation, but the conversation, thankfully, is more balanced and based on an array of data as opposed to the Women's Health Initiative in 2002, which came out like a thunderstorm and unfortunately did women and their clinicians a disservice. And what the data are showing after time has passed is that there certainly are risks associated with hormone replacement therapy and that the progestogen in hormone replacement therapy probably poses the most risk vis-a-vis breast cancer risks, strokes, heart disease, and blood clots, and that estrogen alone is safer. But that overall, again, that the risks of these adverse sequelae are very, very small, and that the benefits to women who are suffering from these symptoms are tremendous. So it certainly should be something discussed with your physician and certainly considered if you're struggling.
And if your estrogen is increasing when you're postmenopausal, which I'm assuming is accurate, for some women that also brings an increase in potential breast cancer. Is the recommendation still an annual mammogram unless you have dense breast and then it's an ultrasound and or mammogram yearly?
So estrogen actually is not increasing in the menopause.
Oh, it's not?
No, it is not, actually. The majority of our estrogen comes from our ovaries, and our ovaries become much more quiescent in menopause so that our estrogen levels are actually declining, which is why we have the symptoms of the vasomotor symptoms, those hot flashes or flushes or warm flushes, or the vaginal dryness. Those are from an estrogen deficiency or not enough estrogen. The mammogram question. So the mammograms, Amy and I were discussing this also on our way up, and there's a lot of confusion about mammogram screening and different recommendations depending on which organization you listen to, which is it's very confusing. It's not so easy for us as clinicians, and certainly really confusing for the lay public. But what I think is a reasonable screening modality or schedule is a baseline mammogram at age 40, and then based on your family history, your exam, your concern, either a mammogram every other year or every year, depending again on your individual characteristics, and then from 50 onwards, an annual mammogram. I think that as our imaging modalities get better, as we are able to learn more what bad lumps and bumps look like on imaging, I think we will have a better sense of who we need to screen more frequently. And we're hoping that maybe we'll find the HPV of cervical cancer for mammograms. So we could find something that would that would say, yes, this person is at high risk. This is a higher risk situation than someone else.
But don't we already have that, Rachel, in terms of the genetic testing that some women have get and say, no, you're at higher risk?
Well, certainly, yes. The people who have BRCA, the BRCA testing, those people certainly are at higher risk for both breast and ovarian cancers. But there is a whole cohort of women who are BRCA negative who we need to know based on their personal history and on their mammograms, if we see something, is that something concerning, or is it something that could just remain quiescent for years, decades?
Gotcha.
I just went through my first biopsy and it was negative, but I'm just not really eager to go digging around in the breast that often. And I have the dense breasts, which they read with ultrasounds and mammos, and they give you lumps and bumps and things that can't be read, and so they go in and they want to take a look. So you get the X-ray every year, and then you maybe get people having to go in there and dig around because they think they see something, and it's not a cyst, but then it isn't anything. Maybe it's calcification, but it turns out to be nothing.
In some cases, fibroids, right?
Not in the breast.
Not in the breast.
No,
okay.
Fibroadenomas, I think, is what you're talking about. But that is the issue, is a lot of the false positives and what we see, and that's why we're trying to figure out something that can help us decide who we need to biopsy and who we don't. And we are getting closer, but we're not quite there yet.
Okay.
Thanks.
Carolyn, thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Let's go to Jean in Schenectady. She's back. Jean, you're on.
Hi. My question is, I've had 10 years of atypical pap smear. 8 years were atypical squamous, and the last 2 years, atypical glandular. I have tested negative for HPV. What would be your course of response or action? What should I be watching for and paying close attention to?
Hi, Jean. I imagine it's quite frustrating to have your pap smears done. I'm sorry, I don't know if you mentioned your age.
I'm 55.
Thank you. Your situation is certainly not unusual. However, as Rachel has pointed out, we know that HPV is the causative agent for cervical cancer. We do get more concerned about glandular abnormalities than the squamous type of abnormality. And so certainly when there are glandular abnormalities on a pap smear, we recommend, based on the American College of OBGYN and several other expert governing boards, that you have a number of tests, everything from a colposcopy to an endocervical curetting and an endometrial biopsy, because the glandular abnormalities are suggesting that the abnormalities are coming from within the canal of the cervix or higher up in the uterus. Moreover, with that many years of abnormal PAPs, there certainly may be room for a discussion with your clinician about more definitive surgery, which is a very big decision. But having a negative HPV is certainly reassuring, but not definitive when there's been these when there are these glandular abnormalities.
I thank you very much for your information.
Well, thank you. Okay, let's go to D in Hudson. Okay, D in Hudson, you're on.
Here I am.
Okay.
So the woman that spoke before me sort of had the same scenario that I'm dealing with. About 6 months ago, I had atypical glandular cells in my pap smear. I did undergo a colposcopy, biopsy of the uterus, and ultrasound of the cervix and the endometrial. Everything came back negative. Then in that time, I became fully menopaused. Okay, I am 49, I believe. And I started bleeding when I was fully menopaused, went back to the doctor. She did the endometrial biopsy again and not finding anything. You kind of addressed that just now. Should I continue to pursue care or?
So are you, just a quick question for you. When you say you were fully menopause,
yep.
Have you been 12 months? Did you go 12 months without any bleeding at all?
I was actually 13 months.
Okay.
No bleeding at all.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So that's just so that we're all defining it the same way. We define menopause by if you're over 40 years old and you don't have any menstrual bleeding for a full 12 months.
For a full year, right.
Right. So that was you. Okay. So I would say that, you know, I think that you are in that time frame that Amy was talking about, that 3 to 5 years of menopause, that transition time, that your hormones may still be somewhat fluctuating, and you have done all of the right things in terms of getting this worked up with your atypical glandular cell pap smear. As Amy said before, the glandular cells are higher up either in the cervix or in the uterus, so we need to make sure that there's nothing going on in either of those two places.
Right.
And it seems that you have had your colposcopy, your endocervical curettage, the endometrial biopsy, and an ultrasound, and then you've had it done again. And I would say to you that those things being negative are very, very reassuring in terms of, yeah.
So, Dee, I've got to let you go because we're really running out of time now. Appreciate it very much. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I guess we're all done because Dee from Hudson was not there when I looked up. So do you guys want to say anything? Because we have a few seconds, but that's all, about a minute. Is there anything you want to end up with?
I just want to say one thing. We were talking earlier, I have two things to say. One about the Women's Health Initiative, and Amy had mentioned the estrogen alone arm of the study, which we think that maybe the progestins are being more implicated in some of the bad outcomes that were witnessed in that study. But I just want to say for women who still have uteri, who still have their uterus, taking estrogen by itself is not recommended because that is what can cause a thickening of the lining of the endometrium. So we need women who still have their uterus should not take estrogen alone, unopposed. That's what we call unopposed estrogen. And I just want to make sure that that's perfectly clear to everybody out there.
Amy?
Yeah, and I want to just articulate some of the definitions that we've been using today. Women are often asking me about the menopause and what that means. And as Rachel pointed out, the menopause is literally the last menstrual period. And only when you've gone 12 months without another period can you say you're in the post-menopause. And a question that's often asked of me is, how can I know when I'm going to have my last menstrual period? And I usually respond with, your guess is as good as mine. That the average age in this country is 52 and a half, but that's average, which means there are women in my office who are 42 or 43, and I have a 59-year-old woman who's menstruating every month as if she were 17. So it does vary, and that there is no test or there are no tests at this point in time that predict when your last menstrual period would be. So there's some guesswork that goes on and some assumptions based on people's clinical status and signs and symptoms.
We are just about out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in and apologize to Geraldine, who we left on the telephone. Dr. Amy Novat and Dr. Rachel Mash, thank you for joining us today. You guys are wonderful. It's just so great to have you here, and I hope you'll keep coming back because you're terrific. You deserve your own show. That's what I got to say. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell for answering the phone. She's terrific. Tom Job handled our social media today. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.